Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. I'm going to call order the Senate Committee of Judiciary. First, I'd like to apologize to everyone that's here that was here on time at 8 o'clock. The chair had it down at 8:30. I had this nagging thought in my mind, wait a second. Olis told me, yes, you're right, and you can only go so fast to get here. So I apologize to everyone that got here punctual, especially on a Monday that happens to be President's Day. So with that, we're going to start with our first panel, which will be Representative Jennifer Williamson, Attorney General Ellen Rosenbaum, and Tim Nord. Thank you very much for all of you being here on time and accounted for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jennifer Williamson. I'm a state representative for House District 36, which is downtown, northwest, and southwest Portland. Happy President's Day. I think everyone here has probably heard this bill before. As we all know, currently in Oregon, unclaimed awards and class actions remain with the defendant under current law, even if that defendant has been found at fault and the damages have been awarded. This means for every person that the court cannot locate or did not respond to the notice in the case, the defendant keeps that part of the award, and they do not pay the full award of their damages. 2700, this bill would close the loophole in Oregon, and it would allow judges discretion over 50% of those unclaimed damages to award to a nonprofit or to an organization that addresses the issue at the problem at issue in the class action, and 50% of those remaining funds would go to legal aid. Legal aid in Oregon, as we all know, is severely underfunded, with only one lawyer for every 9,400 Oregonians. Legal aid is currently serving only 15% of the need in the state. We know that this kind of Cypre legislation works to help fund legal aid, and 11 other states have amended or enacted statutes encouraging unclaimed funds to go to legal aid, and this solves two problems, I believe, at one time, which is making sure that those found at fault pay the full cost of their damages and address the access to civil justice in the state of Oregon that we are so severely lacking right now. So, colleagues, I won't belabor the point because we've all heard it, and I believe this is a good bill for Oregonians and for consumers, and so I hope you will pass the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Attorney General for the state of Oregon, and I come before you in support of House Bill 2700. With me is Tim Nord, Assistant Attorney General. Mr. Nord has some greater depth of expertise on some of the details of the bill, so after I conclude my presentation, he would be happy to answer perhaps more technical questions. I'm very glad to be back. I was a strong supporter of the fair distribution to legal aid of residual funds in a class action lawsuit in 2014 when it came before you as House Bill 4143. I return today to reiterate that support and to urge you again to end the peculiar and unfair practice of returning unclaimed award monies in a class action lawsuit to the very company or individual who caused the harm. This is a practice not followed by the vast majority of states, and I believe it needs to end here in Oregon as well. It would not be surprising if most of you have been involved in a class action lawsuit at some point in your lives. If you didn't know about it or didn't pay attention to it, you're in the majority. Often more than half of the victims in a class action lawsuit either don't receive notice of the suit or do not respond. Most of us find out that we're victims in a class action lawsuit when we receive a letter in the mail letting us know that we may be entitled to compensation, usually a very small amount of compensation, if we fill out the enclosed paperwork and return it. Much of the time, the amount can seem like it's too small to justify the time and effort, so nothing is sent back. It's also business as usual for the notice to go to a bad address or for no address to be found in your name. These very small amounts of money may not be enough to motivate every eligible victim to send the paperwork in, but all of these very small amounts can add up to very large awards. And if victims are so hard to find, so much so that in a typical class action lawsuit, it's not at all unusual to see over half of the award go unclaimed, the amount that ends up being undistributed is very significant. And this raises the question for which House Bill 2700 provides an answer: what to do with all of that unclaimed leftover money. Oregon's current practice is to give the money back to the company or person who caused the harm in the first place. This simply makes no sense. These awards do not simply represent dollars awarded. They represent the very real harm caused by these defendants. They represent carcinogens seeping into groundwater, heart disease caused by pharmaceuticals, and unfair fees imposed on consumers. The fact that a victim cannot be found doesn't undo the harm. And so it strikes me as unfair that the award should simply be returned to the person or company that caused it. House Bill 2700 corrects this inequity through a legal doctrine known as CPRAE. CPRAE, which is a French term meaning next best, allows these uncollected funds to go to a charitable purpose in lieu of going back to the culpable defendant. In around a dozen states, including Washington, these funds are routed in whole or in part to legal services for the poor. This practice has been in effect for many years and across multiple substantial awards, and has thus far been found appropriate by both courts and legislatures. This bill follows the path established by these states in requiring 50% of any residual amount to be deposited in an account dedicated to the funding of legal aid, with up to 50% eligible to be awarded by the judge to any charitable purpose related to the underlying harm. This reflects the CPRAE preference for the next best. If you can't find a person harmed by cigarettes, the next best thing is to fund tobacco cessation. If you can't find a person sickened by an industrial toxin, the next best thing is to provide support for treatment. If a judge does not make such a designation, the proposal permits the entirety of the award to be provided to legal services for the poor at their discretion. So, like House Bill 4134, attorneys at the Department of Justice were asked at my request to perform an analysis of the legal fitness of this bill. And it has been determined, I have a back page here somewhere, that this bill is legally sound. Firmly modeled after well-established provisions from other states, House Bill 2700 is not a taking or a violation of due process or any other legal provision. I understand that there are many people who wish to speak on this issue, so I will not try to address every argument that one could theoretically make, except to say that House Bill 2700 is not unworkable, and it is not unlawful, and it is fair. And, of course, this bill is not new. Indeed, a bill very similar to this one was introduced by Attorney General Hardy Myers and has been reintroduced several times since then. I don't know that anyone here would question that there be maybe no more worthy cause than providing access to justice for those in need of legal services and who are simply too poor to afford them. To give you a sense of the extent of the need here in Oregon and how this bill would benefit our citizens, Oregon currently has two statewide legal aid programs with offices throughout the state and two smaller county-specific programs in Lane County and Medford. Together, these programs provide legal services in all 36 Oregon counties. This year, Oregon's legal aid programs will provide direct legal services to about 22,000 low-income Oregonians. There are more than 850,000 low-income Oregonians who qualify for assistance, and only 90 legal aid attorneys to serve them. It is anticipated that there are currently resources, as Representative Williamson just told you, to meet about 15% of the civil legal needs of the poor in Oregon. It used to be 20, now it's down to 15. One of the unique features of Oregon's legal aid programs is that they closely collaborate on funding and service delivery and strive to provide relatively equal access to justice to all Oregonians, regardless of where they live in the state. But the sheer size of Oregon presents its challenges. From 2010 to 2013, funding for Oregon's legal aid programs decreased dramatically, causing programs to reduce their staffing by 20% and close two legal aid offices. And these cuts came at a time when poverty was on a sharp rise in Oregon. Between 2000 and 2011, those eligible for free legal services grew in Oregon by 61.5%, the eighth largest growth in poverty in the nation. Passage of this bill would go a long way to help fill the access to justice gap that tarnishes our state and hurts our citizens who have nowhere else to turn for legal help at critical junctures in their lives. But it is also important that Oregon finally step forward and join our neighbors in taking the equitable step of not returning residual damages to the very person or company that inflicted them. It's time for Oregon to join the larger community of our sister states and make the right decision. So I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you so much. And as I indicated, Mr. Nord is available if you wish to ask questions, and I as well am available.
Let me ask Tim, is there something else that you'd like to put on the record at this stage or just here to answer any questions?
Chairman Przanski, Tim Nord, Oregon Department of Justice. Yes, I'm available for any questions. If you want to put this in context, any cases, I'm here to discuss that.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Looks like everyone's off the hook. So what I'm going to do, I'm looking at the time, and I know we have one individual that needs to be out here in about 45 minutes, but I think what I'm going to go ahead and do is take a panel of opposition so we can just kind of rotate. So I'm going to go ahead and call up Brad Daniels, Betsy Earls, and Greg Chamoff. While they're coming up, I do know we have another group of panelists, Jane Downing, Travis Presswick, and Lane Shutterly, that are scheduled to testify. Besides those three, are there others who will want to be testifying so we can make certain we accommodate time-wise? Gentlemen, why don't you go ahead and get started.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Brad Daniels. I'm a partner at Stoll Reeves in Portland. My practice includes litigating class actions, and I'm also one of the trial attorneys who represent BP West Coast Products in a pending class action in Portland. I do want to echo the statements of earlier speakers. Legal aid does need a source of strong and stable funding. The problem with this bill is not the Cypre provision or the focus on legal aid. The problem is that it's a fundamentally flawed way to handle class actions procedurally. I would like to briefly summarize those flaws and then conclude with a statement on potential alternatives. House Bill 2700 changes the rules of the game. It changes how classes are defined, how damages are determined, and whether those damages will be distributed to some or any individual Oregonians who are entitled to them. These are not merely technical changes. They are a fundamental change to Oregon's class actions procedures that have been in place for 40 years. Through these changes, House Bill 2700 does not bring Oregon in line with other states. If it passes, Oregon would be the only state to do it this way. No other state would have this unique procedure for handling class actions. Why should these unprecedented changes be carefully considered and rejected? First, it upsets the balance and fairness in the current system. Current law has a relatively low threshold for allowing class actions to overcome the initial procedural hurdle called certification. That low threshold is balanced by a claim form procedure at the back end, a procedure that protects the individual rights of absent class members to decide whether to file claims in a class actions, and protects the rights of businesses or other defendants by ensuring that they only pay valid proven claims to people who decide to be class members. House Bill 2700 fundamentally changes that dynamic. While it keeps the low front-end threshold, it eliminates the claim form process and allows the court to divert damages from those who are members of the class to non-parties such as legal aid on the basis that payment to an injured class member is not practicable. And by precluding members who have not been made whole from bringing an individual action on their own, the bill risks depriving people of their claim and a remedy for their harm. House Bill 2700 also allows a court to impose an aggregate award of damages that no class member has actually claimed or proven and against which a defendant has no opportunity to defend, a procedure that courts have expressed serious reservations about. The other reason is unpredictability. Because it would impose an unprecedented procedure, House Bill 2700 will make it more difficult and expensive to litigate and settle class actions. Parties will be unable to agree what the class will be, what the damages are, and what procedure will govern. That not only hurts businesses who are faced with lawsuits, but Oregonians and others who benefit when these cases get resolved more quickly and expeditiously. I submit that there is an alternative. If you want to eliminate Oregon's class action claim form requirement, enact a CyPRE provision, and give courts guidance for the future, there's an easy way to do this. You can bring Oregon's rule into line with what every federal court does and 37 other states do. Amending the rule in that way would provide clear guidance to Oregon courts. It would permit legitimate class actions to be certified and proceed while preserving the procedural safeguards that are essential and have been developed by numerous courts over many decades. That's exactly what Washington does. Washington's Rule 23 closely tracks the federal rule with respect to the procedural aspects of a class action, but it also includes a CyPRE provision that directs unclaimed funds to legal aid. Oregon can and should take the same approach, which would be a much better alternative and would avoid the uncertainty and risks that House Bill 2700 presents. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Who's going to go next?
Greg.
Chair, members, good morning. Greg Chamot from the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, appearing on behalf of the Reform Coalition. This is a difficult bill for lawyers to criticize because the bill hopes to provide resources to legal aid services, and access to justice is among the most, if not the most important issue for lawyers. I am honored to work at a firm that encourages its attorneys to donate a month a year of their time in service to the poor. But the importance of the goal of this bill doesn't support the path for getting there. There are two practical problems with the bill. First, it's going to make settling class actions much harder. Class actions are much more likely to go to trial. Most class actions settle, and they settle with the defendant putting up a pot of money that is knowingly larger than the defendant expects the defendant will have to pay. This bill encourages an opposite incentive, which is to aim low, because the defendant doesn't want to end up paying more than the defendant anticipates. So when you aim low, you are more likely to go to trial. Now, for those of us who are attorneys, that can be a good thing because we get richer. It is not a good thing for the system as a whole. You ought to have a system in place that encourages the resolution of disputes without the use of the court system. And second, I appreciate that the bill has the support of the Attorney General. But back in the days when I was defending class actions against the state, I would have advised the Attorney General to oppose the bill out of concern for the potential liability of the state. The written materials you have discusses the current case against the state lottery, but I wanted to leave you with one other example which shows why this is a dangerous path to pursue. It used to be that Oregon's law provided that no worker got overtime except those on a list provided by the Legislative Assembly. And that list got so long that the Legislative Assembly switched the concept around so that everyone got overtime except the workers who were on the list. And when the Legislative Assembly made that change, the Legislative Assembly omitted from the list state managers. Now, that was a mistake. It was a mistake that was not made on your watch, and it was not, I would like to note, made on my watch when I was legislative counsel. But there was then a class action filed on behalf of all state managers saying, thank you very much, we would like our overtime. The court said, we don't care if the legislature made a mistake. The legislature said state managers get overtime. Now, most of us who were state managers at the time thought that the lawsuit was ridiculous. We knew when we took our jobs that because we were taking jobs as managers, we were not going to get overtime, and we couldn't in good conscience take the money that was available to class members. And under the law then, and as it is now, taxpayers didn't have to pay for the legislature's mistake. But under this bill, taxpayers could. And it's that problem with the bill that this committee should fix. Funding legal aid services is an absolutely wonderful thing to do, and you should encourage ways to do that, but not through a bill that encourages trial instead of settlement, and not through a bill that puts a procedure in place that is going to require governments, because governments are the folks who happen to operate without keeping very good records of the services they provide to the public, being the ones that fund legal aid services. Thank you.
Thank you. Betsy?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, and appearing before you in opposition to House Bill 2700 as it's currently written. AOI represents roughly 1,500 businesses across the state of Oregon, and those businesses provide roughly 200,000 jobs to workers across the state. All of those companies need a stable and dependable legal environment in order to run their businesses and continue to provide jobs. So I would like to take just a little bit of a step back from the details of the bill and talk about kind of the overall stability of the business environment. Oregon might never be the cheapest place to do business, but it could very well be the most stable place, and that is what we're shooting for this session. The business community values stability very, very highly because a stable business climate allows companies to plan effectively at all levels, from how many people they can hire to the type and amount of raw material they need to purchase to when to schedule shipments. And a stable business climate, of course, also contributes to a strong economy. Unfortunately, the way House Bill 2700 is written right now, it would seriously erode the stability of Oregon's legal system by disposing of well-established rules by which damages and class actions are determined, and in their place, applying new rules to cases that have already been tried and verdict rendered. This committee might be aware that there are several pending class actions in Oregon, and one of those will soon be subject to what's probably going to be a significant judgment. It's very tempting to make this bill retroactive in order to capture those funds for legal aid, but the reality is that legal aid is unlikely to recognize revenue from the case this biennium, possibly not next biennium, and potentially never. If you impose such procedural changes midstream, it's fundamentally unfair to the parties, the plaintiffs and the defendants alike, who've been litigating their cases according to the procedural rules that Oregon has followed for decades. Defendants have made settlement decisions, they've determined strategy, they've won and lost motions based on the rules in place when they litigated those cases. Class members have been notified of their rights and they've made decisions based on what were existing procedural rules. Changing the rules in the middle of the game, such as 2700 does right now, would seriously destabilize Oregon's legal system, and it sends an absolutely terrible message to the business community in this state and to those considering coming to Oregon. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? I have a couple. And Brad, this may be for you or for Greg, because both of you kind of touched on it. Brad, you were talking about what the alternative could be. The model that's used, if I got this right, by the feds as well as 37 states. And Greg, what you had said in your presentation was the changing and going to this type of process was going to cause the litigation to cost more and be more timely. And I'm wondering if we have any data regarding those 37 states and the fed system who apparently have a CPRE or CyPRE, however you want to pronounce it, system into their class action lawsuits?
Chair Przanski, data in terms of the percentage of cases that settle or measuring what metric?
I guess what I would say is what I took away from this is by going to a system that has CyPRE that we're going to see the cost of litigation in these cases go up because there's going to be the uncertainty of how much is going to be owed and such. And so I just took a blending of what I heard between the two, knowing that we have some type of history with these 37 states plus the federal system as compared to what is forecast by us making this change. What does that show us? I mean, are these other states, does it take longer than what it took before they had a CyPRE model?
Chair Przanski, thank you for the clarification. The significance of the federal government and the 37 other states is that they have a balanced system where in order for a class to be certified, common issues must predominate, which is unlike Oregon's current procedure. And that's a well-recognized procedural step that both plaintiffs and defendants can assess and understand when they're engaged in settlement negotiations. The federal government and those other states also generally will require a claims process at the end for individual damages that can be determined. And again, that increases predictability that allows people to assess their risk. I don't have a specific data in terms of time or exposure, but I know from experience that having a predictable procedural system that all parties recognize allow both sides to engage in meaningful and informed settlement negotiations.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I don't think I was saying that the Cypre in and of itself is a bad idea. It's how you get there. Mm-hmm. It's the creation of the pot of money that then goes in different ways. Currently, Oregon has a way of determining who's in and who's out. And what this bill does is essentially remove that initial structure for determining that liability. And because you are removing that structure, that's where you're going to cause a lot of litigation.
Mr. Chair, I would add to that from AOI's perspective, I don't think it's the Cypre piece that is causing the concern. It's the retroactive changing of the procedural rules.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that, but do you have a question, Senator Burdick, based on what we just heard?
Yes, I do, and I apologize for being late. I got some bad info about the starting time.
Are you replacing your staff as well?
There are dead bodies in the hallway, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to get my mind wrapped around this. The procedure for determining the class is a separate issue from where the damages go. Is that correct?
Chair Przanski, Senator Burdick, correct.
Now, you said that that in the cases of the 37 states that there still is a claims process at the end?
Chair Przanski, Senator Burdick, that's generally correct. It's not specifically prescribed in the federal rules, but courts, when they can run a claims process, will do so.
So with that claims process, Mr. Chair, claims process, if there's money left in the pot because not everybody files a claim, what happens to that money in the other states?
Chair Przanski, Senator Burdick, if the state does have a provision with a Cypre, like what 2700 has, it would that provision would be invoked, and it would go to whether it be legal aid or another organization. In states or, for example, in the federal system without a specific CPRE provision, it's up to the discretion of the court. We'll say, in my experience, a majority of the courts will invoke a CPRE, but it's not required.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. All right, thank you. So, Betsy, I guess I wanted to follow up where you've used the term retroactive. My reading of the bill, it looks like what they've done is they've basically just set up and said that the point of determination will be at final judgment, and basically my reading of Section 5 says that this bill would be applicable to any case that has not had a final judgment. So to me, retroactive means that something has been finally judged, and then you go back and try to gather that. So maybe it's just a term of art, but it doesn't seem to me that we have retroactive. We just have a point of where it will be effective on the for any matter that's still pending without a final judgment, as compared to, I believe, the dash one show commencement of a lawsuit.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the clarification. I shouldn't have used that term, and it's been a few days since I testified on this bill, and I forgot not to use it. But what I meant to say when I used the term retroactive is simply that you're imposing new rules midstream before a case has been all the way through, you know, the final appeals process and final judgment, and decisions that people might have made at the beginning of their case based on what they expected to happen at the end, based on the procedural rules in place at the time, would be negatively impacted by change in the rules. I guess a better word is midstream.
Okay. So let me just follow up on that. Everyone knows we had this bill before us last session, the small session. It went down 15-15. So to me, I guess people should have been somewhat on notice that this was probably an issue that's going to be coming back before this legislature, which it has now. Knowing that the concerns that I've heard about at least one case that's pending now without a final judgment, I'm wondering if you could tell me why the business leaders of that organization didn't think about trying to resolve this case and get through this process before we came in session, knowing that there's more than likely, a high likely, that the bill was going to be passed as it was presented the last time.
Mr. Chair, I am not in a position to speak for the business leaders that run that company. What I would say to you is that it's not always up to only them to get something like this over and done with, because they're dealing with multiple other parties, court filing deadlines, and things like that. But that's about as far as I'm willing to go in speculation.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much.
Thank you,
for coming forward.
Thank you.
The next panel I have that's listed here is Jane Downing, Travis Presswick, excuse me, and Lane Shutterly. And Mr. Nord, I see that you're here. If you could stay by, because there may be some technical questions that we may have after the panels are done. And whoever wants to start first, I know, Travis, you have a need to be, probably be in court shortly. So
I do.
If you want to go ahead and go start.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. I'm already thinking about court. I just almost refer to you as Your Honor, but
don't do that.
In any event, Chair Przanski, as you know, my name is Travis Presswich. I'm an attorney here in Salem. I have a practice here in Salem. But I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar's Board of Governors. I'm the chair of the Public Affairs Committee, which handles its legislative efforts. And I want to thank you all first for giving us the opportunity to speak. The Oregon State Bar's highest priority is access to justice. This includes not only ensuring adequate court funding, but also ensures funding for low-income legal services, both on the criminal side of cases as well as civil cases. Legal aid plays an essential role in providing this access to justice for thousands of low-income Oregonians, and we're constantly looking for new ways to make sure that this need for service is met. A legal aid attorney's advocacy can help a family stay in their home, can help a domestic violence victim obtain a restraining order, and also can help a taxpayer negotiate a settlement, for example. This ensures not only that our court system runs smoothly and efficiently, but it also provides economic benefit to Oregon, because it allows that individual who needs representation to avoid the individual processing of the case themselves. It allows them to utilize legal aid services to quickly and effectively address and rectify what can be a daunting legal task for that individual. As you've heard, it's estimated that Oregon currently meets about 15% of legal needs of qualifying Oregonians. There are over 850,000 Oregonians that have incomes that are low enough to qualify for legal aid representation. This number has increased about 60% over the last 15 years due to economic circumstances, and particularly due to the Great Recession that we've all experienced. Despite this ever-increasing need, legal aid has struggled to even maintain their existing levels of service due to the decreases in funding of some sources. At one time, the federal government provided a great portion of legal aid funding, but currently there are approximately 80 different sources for legal aid funding in Oregon. Those include things like interest on lawyer trust accounts, IOLTA accounts, as they're commonly referred to. Back in 2007, those interest-bearing accounts provided $3.6 million to legal aid, whereas today, given the current interest rates, provide less than $1 million for that source. As you've heard others testify, national standards define minimally adequate legal aid services as two legal aid lawyers per 10,000 low-income citizens. We currently provide about one legal aid lawyer per 10,000. We have 90 legal aid lawyers working throughout the state. The Oregon State Bar has historically been supportive of CPRAE. I'm going to follow the Attorney General's lead and refer to it as CPRAE, which indicates, as you've heard, that any residual funds from a class action case will be provided to its highest and best use, or an alternative use where the victim can't be identified and funded. Dedicating some or all of these residual funds from class action to legal services is a practice in most states and a practice under the federal system. The bar is committed to working with representatives from all three branches of government, with legal aid programs, the Campaign for Equal Justice, and the Oregon Law Foundation to ensure that legal aid funding is adequate here in Oregon. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Travis, knowing that you have court, I'm just going to ask if anyone has any questions for Travis at this point.
Ms. Chair,
Senator Burdick.
Just a quick one. Do you know of other cases where a law change like this is made, like, midstream, in a where it's affecting some litigation midstream?
Chair Prozonsky, Senator Burke, are you referring to CPRE in particular or other types of cases generally?
Well, other types of cases where you have a law change that will affect major litigation midstream.
Chair Prozonsky, Senator Burdick, I can't speak to individual cases. Certainly my experience in testifying here in front of the legislature and working as a legislative assistant years ago, I have seen legislation that can affect cases or individual circumstances that happen at the moment. I would, in terms of referring to this particular legislative change as retroactive versus midstream, I think the comments earlier that were referred to by the Attorney General and others that spoke in favor of this legislation have indicated that that this particular legislation does not affect any cases where a final judgment has been rendered, giving the parties an opportunity to address that. But again, I'm not an expert in this particular area. I'm here to testify in support of legal aid funding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for him? All right, who would like to go next?
Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee, my name is Jane Downing, and I'm the executive director of the Center for Hope and Safety, formerly Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service. For more than 24 years, I've been working with victims of domestic violence in Marion County. In that time, I've seen thousands of individuals that are in need of legal services. I would tell you, actually, every single day across the state of Oregon, victims are coming into offices like ours, and they have two primary needs: housing and legal services. And unfortunately, although our legal aid office here locally tries its very best to serve the needs of victims of domestic violence, very few of them are able to be seen. Anything that we can do to help these hardworking individuals be able to help more individuals who are suffering, who are trying their very best to rebuild their lives free of violence, that in my mind is something that we should support in any way that we can. I'm hoping that each and every one of you will think about some of the most vulnerable folks in your communities who are in need of these services, and I really encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Lane?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. For the record, Lane Shetterly. I'm an attorney in private practice over in Dallas, and I'm here this morning as a member of the Board of Directors of the Oregon Law Center and Legal Aid Services of Oregon. I also am a member of the Advisory Committee of the Campaign for Equal Justice and a member of the 2014 Task Force on Legal Aid Funding. So I have a great deal of interest in the subject matter of this bill. My testimony will be very brief. Number one, you already have my written testimony. Number two, my testimony has already been given. So I don't have much to say except to acknowledge gratefully your consideration of House Bill 2700. And to remark that Oregon has, I think, a very proud tradition of strong bipartisan support for legal aid funding. This goes back to my day in the legislature and before my time, both in the state legislature and also in our congressional delegation. So in spite of that bipartisan support for legal aid, you have heard that the ability of our legal aid attorneys in the state to meet the need of legal aid services has eroded over time. And so additional means of support, such as are offered by House Bill 2700, are badly needed. I thank you for the consideration of the bill, and we do ask for your support.
Thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to direct to you the same question I asked before. Do you know of a case where the legislature, and you were a longtime member of the Judiciary Committee, you might have even chaired it at some point.
I might have been guilty of that.
Don't admit.
Yeah, I didn't admit.
Before you went to the bright side revenue.
Yeah.
Do you know of other cases where the legislature passed legislation and basically affected whether a criminal or a civil matter midstream, where litigation strategies had already been developed and the case was midway? Do you know of any other cases where that has occurred?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Burdick, I don't have specifics. And after you asked Travis that, I was racking my brain, because you're right. I did spend four terms on judiciary and chaired it for one. What I would say is it's a mixed bag. I think we do it both ways. Both affecting current pending legislation, and in some cases we make the changes prospective, and I think those are always policy considerations, sometimes limited probably by constitutional law. I think we've heard from the Attorney General that that's not the issue in this case. So I don't have any specific examples, except to say that based on my experience, I think there are a number of circumstances where we have done it, enacted laws affecting pending cases and pending claims.
Thank you.
Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. And I'm not sure how to phrase this question, but I'm wondering if, in your experience, there are any typical scenarios in that. I imagine there are a number of motions and appeals and all kinds of actions, court actions, being filed back and forth by both parties, perhaps, maybe not. But I'm wondering if there is a typical length of time for these to be resolved or to, you know, come to some sort of resolution for the next action. The reason I'm asking that is it was asked earlier if the business community should have known that this was coming. And I'm thinking, well, there was an election. Nobody really knew the outcome of it. I didn't. And it even took some days after that to resolve some of the positions. But I'm just wondering what a typical time clock might be in place for some of these actions.
I'll take a stab at that, Mr. Chair. Senator Thatcher, and I will say that I think you'll probably get the same answer from all of us on this panel, that not being class action attorneys, I'm not in a position, I doubt that Travis is, to offer to you what the typical timeline in a class action suit is or might be. I think you have other witnesses here who could probably better answer that question. But I would just respond generally. I think that in the legislature's history, the decision to implement a bill either to pending claims or prospectively really is just largely a policy call that the legislature makes when it adopts the bill. Unless there are specific legal limitations on your ability to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Testimony really was to be short.
And I know you came to talk about legal aid, and I love legal aid, but I can't resist asking you a question based on your experience here in the building and with the law in general. And that is, do you have any opinion on the matter of keeping the formation of the class as it is in the bill, or going with something closer to the version that 37 other states use?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, again, not having any experience in class action, I know what I've heard, same as you. My understanding,
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I asked if there's anyone else, so I'll ask again. Is there anyone else who did not sign up for the witness registration that would like to make comment on House Bill 2700? Not seeing anyone, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing, House Bill 2700. And at this point, we have nothing else scheduled for today. This bill is, I believe, currently posted for a possible work session on Wednesday of this week. And I don't think we have anything else that we need to be doing today. I believe we're back on our, let's say, normal schedule of 8:30. With that, we're concluded and we're adjourned.
Okay.
We're concluded and we're adjourned.
Okay.